Around here, fall plots usually go into the ground around the beginning of September, which means right now is when decisions get made. And Whitetail Hill is who I would call before making those decisions. Like, literally call them. That's one thing that we love about working with Whitetail Hill is you can get a real person on the phone by call or text who will look at your situation, your soil, your shade, your goals, and tell you exactly which blend to plant and how to plant it. If it's the first plot you've ever put in, they'll walk you through the whole thing before and after the sale. And the seed they'll set you up with is good stuff. It's premium germination tested blends with zero filler. And their seed blends are built in Alabama, so you know it's going to handle southern conditions. So don't guess your way through another planting season. Go to whitetailhill.com/southern and use the code Southern for 10% off. And if you're not sure what to plant, ask them. Again, that's whitetailhill.com/southern and use that code Southern for 10% off. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com. All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck. And I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic. And no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find bachelor groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes, or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
And I walk up, find my way to the stand, and I climb up, and I'm sitting there and I'm bow hunting. I think it was like 7:30 in the morning. I hear something coming up going into that pine thicket. This buck pops his head out of the sparkleberry, and he looked right at the base of the tree that I was in, and that climber had been sitting almost from me to you from that trail. The trail went right next to the climber, and he like sat there and he just stared at the base of the tree, like did not move for I don't know how long. You know how it feels like forever when they do that. And he just stared at it for a while, and he just slowly kind of turns around and just eases off without a sound. And then an hour and a half later, a doe comes up and does the same thing. She looks, and she's staring at it, but she doesn't turn around. She's like, I'm just going to go. So she starts going through the opening, and I stop her, and I kill her. I think those deer had been walking past that climber every day, and then one day they saw that it wasn't at the base of the tree anymore, and they're like, huh, there's something different in here. And it's because I was in it. I climbed up that tree. Welcome back, everybody, to another Thursday Q&A edition of the Southern Outdoorsman Podcast. Jacob, how are you doing over
there? I'm doing great because I'm wearing my Bottomland Freezer Queen shirt, baby. Listen, this weekend, Mobile Hunters Expo, Dalton, Georgia. We're going to have a limited edition of these Bottomland Freezer Queen shirts.
And some logo shirts.
And some logo shirts and a bunch of, and some other stuff at the show in our booth. Y'all come hang out with us in Dalton, Georgia. We've heard from a ton of you guys, both through Circle, but also just through social media. People message us that y'all are going to be coming to the show. A lot of y'all are coming to the show, which I'm excited for. Especially a lot of people that's never been.
Yeah, ticket sales are up this year. I talked to Chris about it. He said ticket sales are up. And also the speaker lineup. I think a lot of people are coming for the speaker lineup.
Yeah.
They got Bobby Worthington, first of all, who there were so many people at Bobby's seminar last year. Our booth is right in front of the seminar stage.
Yeah.
There were so many people in front of the seminar stage that I couldn't hear what he was saying because of all the bodies between me and the speakers. Mm-hmm. It was crazy. But so Bobby Worthington, Mariah Boggess, he's going to be talking about oak trees. Mariah's a biologist, a friend of ours. Derek Norwood, y'all heard him on the podcast last year talking about stalking deer in Florida, which was awesome.
Yeah, swamp hunter.
Who else? Oh my gosh, my mind.
Dylan Harper,
who was just on the podcast, what, two months ago?
Yeah, in June.
Big mountain hunter. If you like terrain and maps and mountains, Dylan's your guy.
Yeah.
He is hardcore about it. So he's going to be speaking as well.
And backcountry hunters and anglers.
And, you know, Daniel Williams is going to be there doing a live demonstration of how to cape.
What booth is he in?
I have no idea.
He's posted a booth number, but I never asked him of, like, who's he with.
So he's going to be doing a live demonstration of how to cape a buck off the head in the field. So when you're out hunting this year and you kill a nice buck that you want to mount, Daniel's going to show you how to cape it.
Or specifically, even more important, if you're out of state, because now you can't, there's no states that allow deer to be transported between state lines. Okay.
Yeah.
So if you killed one in Georgia, bring it back to Alabama, it's got to be completely deboned. Same thing with the cape. Can't bring the head back mm-hmm. with the cape attached to it. So with him showing everybody how to cape one off the head, that's how you got to do it so you can bring it across state lines. It's really not that hard. He kind of showed me how to do it like 3-4 years ago. And I do it with all my deer, even the ones I kill in Alabama, because sometimes I just, because we take our deer to Daniel. Daniel's not super close to us. It's a little bit of a drive. He's up in North Alabama. So I'll cape it, and I'll just have the cape all rolled up, mm-hmm. double bag it, and then put it in the freezer, and then skull cap it, and then have my rack right there with me.
Yeah, and a lot, like, I didn't know how to cape a deer off the skull until I, you know, watched an instructional video on how to do it. Once you know how to do it, it's really not difficult at all. So save you a little bit of money having to take it to a taxidermist or a butcher or whatever and have them
for you. Previously, when I've killed deer out of state, both in Tennessee, Arkansas, and Iowa, before I learned how to cape it myself, mm-hmm. I would find a taxidermist locally, and I'd pay him. Like, sometimes, one guy didn't even want to charge him. I gave him, like, $50. I'm like, appreciate it. Thanks for doing it. But mostly, like, $40-$50 for them just to cape it off the head, which really is a heck of a deal for them.
Yeah.
Because it's not hard. It's just, it's nerve-wracking because you don't want to screw it up. Mm-hmm. But once you do it, and I was telling guys this year, and not to get too deep in the subject, but, like, you can practice on, like, if you shoot a buck you're not going to mount, it's a perfect deer for you to practice caping.
Yeah.
So, like, learn from Daniel. I'm sure he's got some, I know he's got some videos on his YouTube channel, Cedar Ridge Chronicles. But learn how to do it with a deer that you're not going to mount, and you'll have the confidence. So when you do kill a buck, you have that capability. Because, listen, it's a lot easier having that cape rolled up, stuck in a freezer, stuck in a small cooler, than trying to deal with a whole head in a rack that probably won't fit in your freezer.
Yep.
Or fit in a cooler, period. So, anyway, that's going to be awesome. But, yeah, get that Mobile Hunter Expo as well.
Yep.
Again, this week in Dalton, Georgia, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Super excited about it. Very excited to see you guys. And we've talked to some listeners, again, coming from pretty far away because they're, like, on the fence. Like, they're trying to get into more mobile hunting. And I say, like, maybe they got a background in using climbers, which a climber is a mobile way to, you know, hunt. Or maybe they're coming from just a ladder stand background, shooting house background, and they're like, man, I want to be able to kind of move around and hunt some different spots. And we've had guys in the circle asking, like, what should I buy? And I'm like, don't take anybody's recommendation. I'm like, there's a lot of stuff I like, but, like, you need to go to the Mobile Hunter Expo because you will save more money, because a lot of the stuff you got to buy online, you can find some of it at pro shops. But if you go, you can try literally everything and piece together exactly what's going to work best for you. So that's one thing I'm really excited about as well, but excited to see you guys in Dalton, Georgia this weekend.
All right, let's kick it off. First up, we've got, some hot takes on whether or not deer recognize your stand. So Cooper McMullen on our Circle account, one of our Circle members, he said, mature pressured bucks know what a trail camera and tree stand looks like, and they will avoid areas if they recognize them. Agree or disagree?
I feel like some bucks definitely recognize trail cameras. I don't really have the experience with ladder stands to know that, but I mean, you've seen it. We've seen it. Like, you put a trail camera out, you get one image of that deer's looking at that camera. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you get on video mode, that sucker, you see that sucker run off. He might not, he's not leaving that area. He's just not going to walk right there no more. He's like, I didn't like what that, whatever that thing is, I'm leaving, you know, that little section. Maybe I'll walk behind it or, you know, stay away from it. But some deer, for whatever reason, definitely do recognize cameras.
Yep.
The ladder stand, I could see that potentially, especially if it's a ladder stand. Same thing with a shooting house, but especially a ladder stand or shooting house, some kind of more of a permanent stand location or, mm-hmm. or hunting location that's being hunted year after year after year, and you educate a lot of deer. Does, mature does will try to circle down one of all that stuff and pay attention. I mean, growing up hunting the farm, you'd have does come out and be trying to stare a hole through a shooting house looking for anything that looks off before they ever stepped out.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me if potentially they did that as well with some ladder stands that just got hunted hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've shared this story before, like years ago. But one time, I think I was probably 16 or something, and I was hunting this club with Colton and Mr. Benny. Mm-hmm. Mr. Benny's my mentor. He's been on the podcast a couple times. And there was this property line that we hunted next to, and it was on top of Mountain Shades Mountain outside of Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And it's on like the end of the mountain. There's some hunting clubs out there close to Taney Hill State Park, if people know where that is. Mm-hmm. And anyways, the top of this mountain hadn't been cut in I don't know how long. So it was very like native habitat-like. So that means it was mountain longleaf pines. And it was like black oaks and things like that. It was really cool. It was really unique habitat. Looking back on it, like I didn't know how good I had it there. Sparkleberry all over the place. So the ridge where these pines were huge. Easily put a climber in them, bigger than a telephone pole. And sparkleberry all throughout. And then there was an old barbed wire fence on the very top of the mountain where the mountain came up and curled over. And there's an old barbed wire fence right there. And on the other side of that fence was a grown-up pine plantation that was like prime, really thick. And there was these trails going through the longleafs, and those trails, it was all that real lofty longleaf pine straw. Mm-hmm. So the trails just looked like cattle trails going through it, where they had matted it down. And there was two or three trails that all came out of the sparkleberry and went through this little opening. It was like probably about the size of this big room that we're in. And it went right through the middle of that opening, and there was a longleaf pine right there on the edge of that. And Benny had put a climber right there. And he dropped me off, and I walked up there one morning before daylight. He hung, like, toilet paper from all the trees because this is before Onyx and all that. And I walk up, find my way to the stand, and I climb up, and I'm sitting there, and I'm bow hunting. And I think it was, like, 7:30 in the morning. I hear something coming up going into that pine thicket. And this buck pops his head out of the sparkleberry. And at the time, it was like the biggest buck I'd ever seen in the woods, and especially the biggest buck I'd seen in bow range in the woods. Like, it was a really nice buck. I didn't kill it. Ended up getting killed later that year. But he poked his head out, and he like into that opening, and he looked right at the base of the tree that I was in. And that climber had been sitting almost from me to you from that trail. The trail went right next to the climber. And he like sat there, and he just stared at the base of the tree, like did not move for I don't know how long. You know how it feels like forever when they do that. And he just stared at it for a while. And then he just like, and I'm like trying to figure out how I can get a shot at him. All I can see is his head and a little bit of his neck. And he just slowly kind of turns around and just eases off without a sound. And then an hour and a half later, a doe comes up and does the same thing. She looks, and she's staring at it, and she's like, but she doesn't turn around. She's like, I'm just going to go. So she starts going through the opening, and I stop her, and I killed her. But I've always wondered, I'm like, I think those deer had been walking past that climber every day, and then one day they saw that it wasn't at the base of the tree anymore, and they're like, huh, there's something different in here. And it's because I was in it. I climbed up that tree. I don't think that they, like, knew. They're like, oh, I wonder if there's a guy in that climber right now. I think it was just they knew it was a man-made object that had moved, and it freaked them out. So,
or maybe not man-made. They just knew it was there. And yeah. Plain, obvious.
Well, I'm sure that they smelled us on it because it has the cushions and everything.
Yeah, but then it's, like, not there anymore, and I'm like, hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that some deer definitely pay attention to stuff like that. And I think some of it's based off experience, pressure, personality of the deer. And like just all those kind of factors probably all play into it. But that's, again, it kind of goes back to the whole idea of one reason I do like the whole you call it mobile hunting, moving around, you know, you're packing your stuff in, whether you're using a climber, a lock-on stand, hang-on stand, or a saddle, and you're always carrying your stuff in and you're carrying stuff out the same day. I just feel like they don't really ever notice that much of, you know, something being there at that time. I've had deer look at climbing sticks before on a tree, but I've never had a deer, I'm trying to think, have I ever had a deer that I could remember that spooked off a climbing stick? I don't think so, but I've had deer notice them.
Yeah.
And like be curious, like, what is that? And mm-hmm. then keep on walking by.
Especially if you leave a little strap hanging and it is kind of fluttering a little bit.
Yeah, but not even, I mean, yeah, that, but just, I feel like some sticks have more of a sheen to them, like a little bit more of a shine.
Yeah.
Which you need to like knock that down. Thankfully, most sticks now aren't that bad, but like I've had sticks in the past that were like kind of shiny.
Yeah.
And you need to rub them in some mud in order to kind of dull them up some. But I've had deer like notice stuff like that, but it's never something that's always there. But again, like a shooting house, but then it's also the flip side. Like, you know, if you're using a pop-up blind, like a ground blind, unless you have that sucker brushed in really, 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 really good, they're going to notice that. And that's one of those things that people typically say, at least with a pop-up blind, if you're going to put a pop-up blind up for deer hunting, turkey hunting is very different. But you need to put it up way ahead of time and let them kind of get accustomed. Like it's there. Okay.
Yeah.
It is just now part of their environment. Same thing like with a shooting house. And they kind of get used to it. But also I've heard people talk about this, like with specifically with shooting houses or box blinds, whatever you want to call them, and pop-up blinds, is if you leave them with the windows shut, okay. Like a pop-up blind, they're zipped up or sealed up. Shooting house, if there's got windows on it that aren't plexiglass, like they're solid windows. I guess they wouldn't be a window then. Covering. If you leave it in that state and then you go and hunt it and you open the windows up and all of a sudden it goes from being like the solid color, whether it's camouflage or pop-up blind or a solid color box blind, and then all of a sudden there's like these black freaking openings in it. Deer notice that in a heartbeat.
Yep.
In a freaking heartbeat. So you see this now with other blind companies, whatever. But like my uncle, what they always did, he always had plexiglass windows mm-hmm. that would slide up or they'd fold up. But he would just paint the whole inside of the blind that where you could, when you're looking outside and you're looking into those windows, he just paints it all black. So whether the window's up or closed, it's black on the inside. Like it looks the same. And I actually was coming back yesterday from West Point, actually picking up some of these shirts, and stopped at, had to take a little bathroom break, so stopped at Woods and Water in Tuscaloosa, and they had some blinds out front. And a lot of their box blinds have, like, black window coverings
mm-hmm.
that would slide up and down, but it's always black.
Mm.
So whether it's open or closed, they're looking into there's a black hole on that side of that blind. And the tough thing, though, about a pop-up blind, specifically, I don't like pop-up blinds. Mostly due to the fact, if you leave that sucker out there, you're going to have some stuff inside that blind. I've never dealt with a snake, but I've dealt with a bunch of weird insects, dude. Listen, I don't know what these things are. Listen, I ain't going to hurt you, but it just, I don't know, freaks. I don't know. I'm very uncomfortable.
Just too many legs.
Ooh, I got chills thinking about it. Like those freaking long-legged, like cricket-looking things.
Oh, it's yeah.
Like a cricket spider or something.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, there's this one time I went turkey hunting with this guy up in North Alabama, and we went to his place. And we got in one of his blinds, bow hunter for turkeys. That's all he does, bow hunt for turkeys. Got in one of his blinds with him. This is years ago. And we got in one of those things, and there was 500 of those big old suckers.
No.
In that blind, falling on you.
No.
Like, they're all up in the corners, and like, the whole, like, I was like, we should burn this to the ground. Okay. Like, this is terrible. Anyways, we sat in there for 3 hours. Waiting for a bird call and nothing happened. And I was like, get me out of this thing, dude. I could not be comfortable. But that's the problem about with a pop-up blind. If you leave the windows open, or even if you don't leave windows open, you're going to have stuff get in there. I've seen guys find snakes inside their pop-up blinds. Again, when they're on the ground, they're not like on a platform. Or all kinds of insects. So those suckers get warm. They want to get inside of it, get up in the corners, stuff. So you got to peek in there and double check, make sure you ain't about to get jumped by something. Hornet's nest. But yeah, so I just going back to deer were definitely recognized. If you leave the window shut and it's a certain color, then you open the windows and it's dark on the inside, they notice that difference very easily.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think it all depends on pressure too. If they're not really getting pressured, I don't think the presence of like a blind or a ladder stand really freaks them out. If you put it out there and you leave it and they're used to it being there, if they're used to associating people with it, then yeah, I think it'll freak them out and they'll avoid it. But moving on, kind of on the same subject, this is another comment from a Circle member. Lane White says, if you've hunted mature bucks the way most people hunt them, you'd swear that they're ghosts too. They're not hard to kill. You're just giving them too many chances to learn you. Most folks will sit the same stand, walk the same route, hunt the same days, and blame the wind, thermals, moon phase, pressure, scent cameras, and everything else when a mature buck disappears. I agree. What do you think?
That was a long enough question. I was going to have to reread it. I'll let you go first real quick.
Okay. You're giving them too many chances to learn you. I think that phrase kind of captures it right there. I mean, I think that they definitely are difficult to catch up with and kill, but sometimes I think that we make it harder than it really is, if that makes sense. And it goes both ways. It's if you're hunting the same spots, if you're not playing the wind right, if you're being patternable, like that's one way that it's difficult. I think the other way that you make it more difficult though is you kind of overthink it and you're over aggressive and you basically try too hard, and then you end up bumping them or whatever, altering their pattern that you otherwise could have taken advantage of. So I think there's a sweet middle ground in there somewhere, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. I definitely think people will get, this is the thing about trail cameras. I think trail cameras are very helpful, like knowing like what you have on the property, the age structure of the bucks in your place, potential just overall deer numbers, okay? I think it will, a lot of times for a lot of people, they get too obsessed with the said buck they've got on camera, and they try to hunt over the camera as much as physically possible if the deer's kind of showing up every couple of days. And just by doing that, you're just going to educate the deer. Which, again, there's not a right or wrong way about it, but I definitely feel like the excitement of trying to shoot a specific mature buck will cause you to put unneeded and unwanted pressure, not just on that deer, but just on the property. So I'm thinking like a public land too, but especially like a hunting club, or if you got a small little acreage, you know, you got 40 acres, something like that to hunt, how you can burn a spot out really quickly,
mm-hmm.
Especially early in the season. You know, maybe during the rut, you catch a buck that's been living on your neighbors or, you know, been living 2 miles down the road, and you're sitting there, and it's the first day he ever walks through there is when you kill him. He didn't know anything about you being there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that happens a ton. But if it's a deer you're trying to kill outside the rut, I think you can definitely just put a whole bunch of extra pressure on there and make it a lot more difficult. Because some of the guys, I mean, we know guys who have a lot of success killing mature deer, specifically on private land, and probably, and I go back to like Alan Summerford's one, and we know some other guys haven't even been on the show, and the whole bit of what they do is they do not worry about trying to kill that deer until the timing is exactly perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And they go in there and they typically kill the deer the first, second time they ever hunt it.
Mm-hmm.
And they leave the pressure, like let their neighbors and everybody else kind of hunt hard. And then they go in there and they kill that buck, but they don't just go in there. They don't go in there before the timing's right. And a lot of time the timing's kind of like that pre-rut time period. You know, the buck's kind of getting up, moving a little bit more. He's not just going to, you know, bed to food. But he's also not wide open, you know, traveling where, you know, he might not be there for a handful of days. And have a lot of success killing deer like that. So I think timing's everything. I think if you had the right timing, the right perspective on it, and a little bit more patience, because we all want to hunt. If you got free time, you got a weekend to go hunt, everybody who's listening or watching this show is going to go hunting every opportunity they get. They're not going to just not go because timing's not right. But that's why if you're blessed enough to have some public land close by, or even a big tract of private land that you got permission on, it's a hunting club or whatever, where you can kind of go hunt other spots and kind of wait for that time to get right on your little core area, I feel like you can make it a little bit easier for yourself. But yeah, I think a lot of deer survive because of that. People get fixated on them, put a lot of pressure on them, and those deer just don't get, they don't get killed because yep. they know the game. They're smelling you. They're seeing you. They're hearing you.
Are you being easy to avoid?
Yeah.
That's the question.
One thing we talk about with almost every guest on this show is map scouting. My favorite map scouting tool is LiDAR. If you're unfamiliar, LiDAR is basically like a 3D scan of the Earth's surface. I like to say it kind of takes away all the surprises. LiDAR is now available on Onyx Hunt on their topography map. If you go to your app right now, click on the topography map, you can flip on that LiDAR feature and boom, it's gonna come on and you're gonna see what I'm talking about. The LiDAR is gonna allow you to see things that are normally hidden from view. This might be ditches, bends in creeks, rocks, old roadbeds. I personally love old roadbeds because deer like to walk them. They're great places to find scrapes. They're great camera locations. And you know, before, an old roadbed or an old logging road might be something that you kind of happen upon while you're out scouting or hunting. Well, now with the LiDAR, before I go into an area, I can turn on that LiDAR and I can see exactly where those roadbeds are. Even old logging roads from the 1930s, you can still see them on there. So that allows me to go straight to those spots and check them out. It's just an incredibly helpful tool, and it's available now on Onyx Hunt. And hey, if you want to get 20% off your Onyx Elite membership, you can use the promo code Southern. Like I said, it's going to save you 20%. Go check out that LiDAR feature. You'll be glad you did. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt.
Y'all have heard me say it a bunch over the years, I love having a diversified freezer. Obviously, we eat a lot of venison around our house, and if I can have some fish in the freezer, maybe some small game, that's even better. But the truth is, I still eat plenty of beef, and I like having really good beef on hand without having to make another trip to the grocery store. That's one of the reasons I've used Omaha Steaks. They help me keep my freezer stocked, and when we decide we want burgers or steaks, I already know I've got the quality meat ready to go. Everything comes individually vacuum sealed, so I can pull out exactly what I need instead of having to thaw a whole pack, just like how I do with my wild game, and it's consistently really good. It's like going to a really nice butcher without having to go to a really nice butcher. One thing I'm really excited to try is their Burger Perfection Flight. So they've got burger made out of all these different cuts like ribeye, filet, New York strip, brisket, and sirloin. And I've had the brisket burgers before and they are excellent. And the cool thing about the Burger Perfection Flight is you can taste the different cuts, the different textures, and kind of get a feel for everything at once. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99 plus get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. See site for details.
Deer season is nearly here and football is back, boys. And whether you've been betting for years or you're just looking to get on a little action on some games, MyBookie is where you should play. That's what's great about MyBookie. You can find the action you want and bet it wherever you are when the game kicks off. From the tree stand, hunting camp, or on your break at work, MyBookie's there for you. And if you're new to the club, the Bet Back Bonus gives you protection on your first play. Sign up with our promo code SOUTHERNOUTDOORSMAN, all one word, then opt into the Bet Back Bonus and take your first shot with a safety net. If your first wager loses, you'll get it right back, no questions asked. Football is finally here. Get in now, cash in on this season with MyBookie. Bet on anything, anytime, anywhere with MyBookie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this kind of goes hand in hand. Andrew Long, he said, mature bucks, this is his hot take. Mature bucks will completely avoid their home areas and move if scouting pressure becomes too much before the season starts. Agree or disagree?
That they'll move their home range?
They will avoid their home areas and move if scouting pressure becomes too much. I completely disagree.
No, I think they might leave that one little bedding area if you keep bumping them, but like he's probably got something else 150 yards away that he can be perfectly fine at. He's not going through a half a mile or something if you bump him that one time. So, I mean, we've seen that. We've seen that at the farm. Anthony, he'd be a great one to talk to about that. There's an area of that farm that is called a sanctuary, or he calls it a sanctuary. And it's really because it's one of the harder places to hunt. It's actually really close to a paved road. It's a section of the property. You go walk through there, you can jump deer out of there any day of the week, and you can jump mature bucks out of that thing. And they keep coming back. I think if you were in there for 7 days in a row walking that spot, that deer probably move out for a couple of days and move right back in. But it comes back to, we're going to interview one of these guys, one of these dog hunters that we know. And they talk about jumping the same buck, like laying eyes on the deer multiple days in the road after they ran it with dogs, jumping it out of the same location every single time, like 3 or 4 days in a row. And they'd be like, we go in there, run that deer any chance we want, but we can't ever kill a deer because he's got all these exit routes and we can't cover them all. So if they find a spot that they feel safe in, they're going to stay in that general area.
Yeah, that's why I say I disagree, because not only talking to guys like who you're mentioning, who we still need to interview, but even some of the GPS things that we've looked at in the past, combined with the dog hunters and the other guys that we've talked to, when you think about it, a buck's home range, it might be 1,000 acres. It might be 600 acres. It might be 400. It might be 1,000, whatever. So you got to think, if you're... Are you like really walking it that hard that he's going to move his complete home range? I think what it's more like that they're doing is like when you go walking through there, you zig and he zags, basically, if that makes sense. He's just avoiding you within his home range. I don't think he's leaving. He's just getting better at avoiding.
He knows that land better than you will ever know it. Okay.
Yeah.
Because he lives out there, especially he's a 5-year-old deer. He's been out there for 5 years. Every single day, every condition, every time, every day of the year, and he knows it much better than you. There are areas that deer will go to that you will probably never go to, because it's in the middle of a little thicket that you will never walk into. You'll walk the edge of it and all that kind of stuff, and you could be walking right by that deer. You think he's gone. Little tidbit on that. I was listening. A buddy of ours, Dan Moultrie, he was on Meat Eater for an elephant interview. And this was recent. I mean, this was this week, actually, came out. And he was talking about when they came up with the trail camera and everything and launched, how he was meeting people, especially in Alabama, at like trade shows, expos and stuff, who they never even realized the quality of deer on their place. Because where they hunted and how they hunted, they just never saw any deer. And he said, he's like, he remembered the first time a guy came up to him. He's like, I've got 150-inch deer in my place. I never knew we even had a deer that big. Never seen a deer like that big in 20 years of hunting there. He's like, they're there. Deer can go, if you took out trail cameras, there are deer, even with trail cameras, there are deer that you just might not know about that are on that place. Okay, and they use it very different from the other bucks. The other deer on the property. And I thought that was eye-opening. He's like it showed people that there are better quality deer than what they're actually killing, which made them more selective with QDMA and so on, and also gave them more confidence that their management strategy and their hunting strategy and everything was actually working, that hey, we could hold a deer like that, or we could potentially have a deer like that grow up on our place. But I think that's absolutely the case. Like, you could very easily have some deer, and Troy Pottinger talked about this years ago when we had on the podcast. Like, I forgot his name of his episode. It's like Scrape Hunting Masterclass or something. Troy Pottinger.
175.
I'm glad you remember that. I couldn't remember that one.
Episode 175.
He kept talking about a term he'd call a trespasser buck. Like, when you have you got cameras out in these big community scrapes and you get all these deer, and all of a sudden this one buck shows up, you ain't never seen. He called a trespass buck. Which is like, he just came over from somewhere. He's like, those are like the bonus deer. Like, you get a real nice one show up. It's like, oh, that's cool. And he's like, you kill that buck, you don't feel like you really did it. You don't feel like you shot one of the ones that's in the area. But there's a very good chance that deer's been there. He just has not been visiting that spot where that camera's been at.
Yeah.
And that's something the GPS data is kind of showing, especially in some of the stuff down here in the deep south that they've been tracking, is some of these bucks do not, and it's not, you know, they ain't collared every single buck on a property. They can't. But these free-range bucks, they're not moving nearly as much in a lot of places as people think. The only thing that I think that hasn't been truly detailed, except for a study out of South Carolina, is, and I guess North Georgia, is with, if you had a GPS collared buck, and hunters out there, or somebody, it doesn't have to be a hunter, with a GPS unit on them, where you could send them in there to intentionally bump that deer multiple times and see how he reacted. I wish they would do that. They did that kind of not on purpose, not telling them where the deer was.
Yeah.
But they tracked him and kind of saw the deer got pushed out and kind of came right back in, typically within 24 hours. But that would be an interesting study, is give a couple guys some GPS handheld units where they could see where that deer's at. those bucks at, and send them in there for a week straight to bump that buck and just see what the buck does. Does he truly relocate where he, like, hey, he is not within 500 yards. I would say that would be relocating.
Okay? Yeah.
He's not within 500 yards, 600 yards of that spot there where he's been at for a week straight, and he stays over there. Or does he do that for 24 hours and then comes right back?
Yep.
That's the study I want to see. Can you put, and again, every buck's going to be different, but can you truly push a deer out?
Let's raise the money. Let's finance that.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Everyone chip in.
See, the funny thing is, I think people be like, oh, that'd be cool. I'd volunteer to do that until the hell holes that buck after the second or third time you bumped him is going to be to try to jump him back out. Yeah, that's going
to
be tough.
Hey, did you get one of those, like that, you know, that briar suit I used to have from Dan's?
Yeah. You don't have it anymore?
No, I sold it.
Why?
Because it's too big.
Oh, all right, skinny sucker.
I bought it when I was about 50 pounds heavier. But, dude, that thing, hey, I don't care what that buck's laying in. You could get to him.
That, and you can get one of their jackets, too, and the bow jackets.
Dude, I'm telling you, you had that.
And some gloves, bro, you'd be invincible.
You'd be like Iron Man.
Yeah.
There, nothing can hurt you.
Like, briar, well, like, what's a briar? What's a black locust? Actually, I don't know. I don't know if I'd go hug a black locust tree, honey locust tree. That'd be bad.
Nah, I don't know. I think that Brian Whidden on Circle had a good response to this conversation that I think is worth reading. He said, that's a good one because I could see people having two sides of opinions. My opinion and what I've seen through camera data and the sign is that the deer just shut down and quit moving when the pressure hits. They avoid the unsafe areas and move thicker, but 100 yards from where they were. As soon as the pressure slows, they go back to moving. At least that's what happens where I hunt. I think that's pretty accurate.
I think that's true. That can be true as well. The problem is with camera studies. This camera is not showing you everything.
Yes.
But it will show you there's a pattern shift, potentially, especially if you have, you know, quite a few cameras out and you're seeing the deer pretty regularly. And they implement hunters, and all of a sudden, they just kind of disappear for a little while. Clearly, there's a shift of what they're doing. But, yeah, I think that happens all the time, especially in areas like where we're at, where the pine tree is the moneymaker, even though all these mills are shutting down, which is unfortunate, where you have checkerboard of habitat in different growth stages of pine trees and clear cuts.
Mm-hmm.
A deer does not have to go in a lot of places that we've hunted more than 150 to 200 yards a lot of times to get into something that is impenetrable where that someone is not going to kill that deer. And there's food in there. There might not be water, but there'll be food. Covering food all in one spot, which makes them where I think when you get areas like that, where you have a lot, like it's not big woods, it's not like big older growth timber, but it's a lot of that checkerboarding of clear cuts and pine thickets and pine stands of different ages. I think a buck could make his whole living on a pretty small area and stay alive just by spending more time in that, thicker stuff. He doesn't have to go through all these wide open areas. There's plenty of food, and he can come. If he wants to pick up acorns, he can do that at night if he needs to.
Yeah.
Versus an area that's big expanse of older timber, bigger timber, still a little bit of thickets, but it's not nearly the abundance of acreage of thick cover.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of those areas that I'm not going to say still necessarily push the deer completely flat out of there, but he's going to use it in a lot more different situation than the buck that's going in one of these big clear cuts, a 100-acre clear cut, and he can make his whole living right there and then bounce out when he needs to.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Moving on. Again, kind of staying on the same subject. This one's kind of about scouting. This is from Kelly Ferguson. This is from our website. So you can submit questions via the contact form on our website. Just putting the subject line, Thursday Q&A. So Kelly says, hey guys, longtime listener, appreciate all the work on the podcast to educate the rest of us. Definitely helps to make us better in the woods. Here's my question. When preseason scouting a new remote national forest area that does not get much pressure, if I jump a big buck that would be a great target buck for the season, what tactics should be used to reduce the impact this interaction could have during season? I'll be honest, I don't think it matters.
No, it doesn't.
At all that you bumped him. Because he's probably going to move anyways before season comes in.
Yeah.
How far he moves, if you're talking about a remote part of National Forest, I'm assuming you're meaning something that's not very not logged a lot, maybe not a lot of roads in there. So the habitat's probably not going to change much, probably going to be kind of monotonous. So
I don't know. I've hunted areas like this, and some of the bucks stay right where you find them in the summer, and some of them go way far away.
Yeah.
Like miles away. So I wouldn't really worry about bumping them. In fact, I would actually be a little excited that I bumped him because I saw him and I know that he exists. So then, with that information, I would be going in there and scouting, you know, maybe in season, just looking for fresh sign after that and trying to nail down where he's at. But especially on a big remote area, I would not worry at all really about bumping him. I don't think that you as an individual, assuming that you're hunting weekends, I don't think that you're going to really cause that much damage, to truth be told. Because again, if he's got one little patch of thicket that he likes to bed in and you bump him out of it 5 weekends in a row, well, he'll probably just go to the next thicket on the other side of the hill and start using that one instead. Mm-hmm. You get what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, try not, once you start getting into season, try not to bump him if you can help it, if you're like in there trying to hunt him. But I don't think there's anything that you could do to like reduce the impact of it per se. I will say if you do bump him, take the opportunity to like really cover that area because you already bumped him. So go look at where he was laying or feeding or whatever and look around and learn everything that you can and go ahead and get your walking out so you don't have to go back and recover that same ground in a month.
Yeah.
Also, just on that, it kind of goes into this same topic, so I want to go ahead and read the next one. This is from Ethan Lehman. I think I said your name right. He's a Circle member. This is a comment from Circle. He said, what's your strategy for scouting in August, September if you're already familiar with an area but want to get a better sense of what deer are in the area and how they're behaving? I love this question. So you're already familiar with the area and you're wanting to get an idea of what the deer are doing and what deer are in the area. This is what I've been doing really starting in the last, I've only gone out maybe twice now. But I save most of my summer scouting for August and September for that reason, because the bucks already have racks. You can figure out what they're going to look like. You can find the bachelor groups. And also, if you're putting out trail cameras, you can, on most trail cameras, if it's a quality camera, you can put it out right now and it's going to not die for the rest, if you just leave it for the rest of until January.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really put out a ton of my cameras. I don't focus on putting them out until right now. I'll have some that I'll kind of leave out there and I'll move around and replace batteries in, but the bulk of them get put out right now. So this past weekend I was doing that. Actually, I went out with Michael Pike. Me and old Pike went and scouted just like old times, dude. It was awesome. We pretty much right off the rip started finding some good stuff. Michael jumped a covey of quail too, which is cool. But anyways, me and Michael went and we scouted an area where I killed one of my bucks in last year on this club. So I'm already kind of familiar with it, but there's some areas that Michael was interested in that I'd hunted maybe twice or three times last year. But when I hunted them, I just kind of walked in the dark and I hadn't preseason scouted it and I saw deer, but I couldn't quite figure out what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So me and Michael went in there, and the way that it sets up is there's a real steep hill that drops down into a creek drainage, and I'd hunted the creek drainage a couple times, and I'd seen deer cross it, and I'd seen sign pop up in specific parts of that creek drainage. So we went and scouted that steep hill because my thought was they're probably coming off that steep hill. Michael liked that area because he hadn't talked to me about it before. He liked it because of the steep hill, because the hill is abnormally steep compared to the rest of the ground around it. So we went and covered that thing, and it has just got trails carved into the side of it. And what was interesting, what we found was where I started picking up sign in the creek drainage,
mm-hmm.
is where that hill kind of drops, and the sign starts basically at the end of that hill. So if the creek's running north and south, it's like on the northern edge of where that hill drops in from the east. So the hill's going east to west, dropping into the creek drainage. When that hill ends, that's where the sign picked up. So what the deer are doing, they're kind of funneling off that hillside to the northwest, like coming down off of it and then crossing that creek drainage. And then they're using that creek drainage to cross and go through some thick cover and hit some draws on the other side that go up through a pine thicket, which is where I killed the buck last year. And so we kind of painted that picture a little bit better. I put a camera in there. And then Michael had to go, and I went and scouted another spot. And this is why I wanted to tie it into the first question that we just read, was because this area, I had one buck in there last year that I was really interested in. He wasn't a deer that I necessarily wanted to shoot last year, but this year he ought to be a real nice one. And so I got to looking at it, and I turkey hunted in this area a lot last year, and there's just a beautiful hub way down in this creek bottom, and it's Alabama, and it's 90 degrees every single day, and it's like 80% humidity. And when you get in those creek bottoms, it is noticeably cooler. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking maybe some deer would be down in that creek bottom, and maybe I could find a scrape or something down there to put a camera on. So I park at the top of the hill, and I drop down in there, and I get to the bottom, and I find this old logging road that runs through the bottom, old, forgotten logging road, grown up and everything. And I get to the bottom, and it goes down, and it flattens out right through the middle of that hub, and it's straight for like 35 yards. And either side of it's like relatively thick, but not really. It's a hardwood bottom. There's just saplings and some grass and stuff. Well, on that roadbed, as soon as you get to that flat spot, there's a magnum scrape right there. Nice one. And then there's another one like 5 yards from it. And then there's a third one 10 yards from that. So there's three big scrapes on this little road right there. So I'm sitting here looking at those scrapes. I'm like, okay, sweet. And I'm trying to figure out where I'm putting my camera. I take like three steps and I hear something to my right and I look over. And dude, there's just deer just everywhere. There's a whole bachelor group of bucks over there. And the first one that jumped up was a nice one, like a good one. And I think I didn't get a great look at like exactly what he was, but he was big. I'm thinking it might be the one that I got on camera in there. I know he made it because I got pictures of him bumping does on like February 10th in a field up above this. Mm-hmm. So he goes running off, and then there was probably five other deer with him. And they were all noticeably smaller body-wise than him. But anyways, bachelor group in there. So I get to looking, and there's a big fallen maple tree right in the middle of that hub. And I go to the end of that maple tree, and sure enough, there's a trail cutting around the canopy side of it where that tree had fallen. And the thing about those hubs, I was talking to another circle member about this today, you go into them, and I saw the bucks in there, so I already know that they're in here, which is why I'm saying, like, I don't care at all that I bumped those deer. I'm glad that I bumped them and that I saw them, especially early August, because, you know, it's not going to damage anything in season. But so I know that they're there, but sometimes those hubs, those deer can walk anywhere through the bottom of that hub, so it's kind of hard to find a defined trail or anything like that. Well, that tree had fallen, and where that canopy was laying, they were going around the tip of it. And there was two defined trails right there that just kind of appeared. And if you followed either one of them 10 yards on either side, they dissipate again. So it's like the deer just kind of flowing through this bottom, and they get to that tree, and they kind of neck down and go around it, and then they flare out again. So I put the camera right there. 5 hours later, there's the bachelor group of bucks coming back through right after dark. So good scouting trip. All that to say, that's what I like to do for early season scouting, for like preseason scouting, I should say, trying to locate the bucks. I feel like I have much better luck getting them in low areas that are cool. Because when you get down there in that cool spot, it is definitely nicer than up on the hill. You can sit down in that. If you're sitting up on the hill, it's like you're going to have a heat stroke just standing there. If you get into that bottom, you could sit on a log and be pretty comfortable. Yeah. Like, it's not bad at all. And I think that's why those deer are down in there. But
also being that bottom, what was the shade difference?
Oh, it was dark down there. Because the other thing about that hub that attracted me to it was the hills above it are like 100 feet tall, and they're pretty steep. So once you get down in there, you're pretty far down, and it's not only shaded by the canopies of all the trees, but you're even shaded by the hills. Mm-hmm. So I wish I had like a little thermometer where I could tell the temperature difference, because it was significant.
You need to carry one of those thermometer guns, whatever, with a laser. And you could just shoot the ground on the hill versus down there in the bottom. It'd tell you a big difference.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me if it's 20-25 degree difference between the two.
Yeah. Yeah, but going back to Ethan's question, again, my strategy for this time of year is just I start putting cameras on good scrapes that I know about that have been good in years past. And then the other thing I put them on is trail intersections. So when me and Michael found those trails cutting around that steep hillside, we found the first one, started walking it. And when I find a trail like that, a good heavy trail, I'll just follow it until it forks. And then I'll typically put the camera where it forks. And this particular hillside had three of those trails on it at different elevations. And so I was walking one, Michael walked the one up above me.
and they're probably like 15 yards apart. And we start going, and they meet in one spot, and then Michael went up again, and there's a different one that just keeps wrapping around the hill. It doesn't drop off. So I put the camera where they dropped off. But that's what I like to do when it comes to just figuring out who's in the area, mm-hmm. who's still alive, who's hanging out. So we'll see. We'll see how it turns out. I put them all out on Saturday. So we'll report back.
So well, the batch group, you know.
So.
Well, what was the biggest one looking like?
So
is it one of the ones you've had on camera?
I don't think I got the biggest one because I forgot to put it on. I forgot to change the settings when I put the camera out. So it was still on single picture and a delay. So I got like two of the younger bucks coming through. And then the next picture I got another deer who's kind of far back and I can't tell what he is and I can't get a video. But yeah, so I changed it now. So next time they come through, hopefully. Hopefully I get to see what they actually look like.
Yeah. Well, where did Pike jump the quail? Was it up on that hill?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's in one of the areas I jumped that big covey last year. So it's probably those same birds. He jumped a pair, though. I don't think they're all coveyed up right now.
No, I thought you said you jumped a covey.
Well, I jumped a covey.
Yeah.
It was like 15. Scared me to death, boy. But anyways.
Yep.
All right. Let's move on. I guess you don't have much to add on the summer scouting.
No, don't at all. No, I have nothing to add.
All right. All right. So this is another comment from Circle. This is Brian Whidden. He said, hot take, most folks put their cameras in the wrong spots. Cameras on trails and open hardwoods or creek bottoms seem nice, but they don't give you the information you need to hunt those deer. I disagree a little bit. What do you think?
I think it comes down to the environment and also when you're going to hunt it. If it's a big, wide-open hardwood bottom that's like there's no cover within 100 yards of it, I mean, it depends. Are you using it to get inventory or are you using
exactly.
it as a tool?
Exactly.
Or are you using it as a tool to find deer and see what's in the air and how they're using it? Or are you using it as a, I'm going to hunt this spot? That's where I think people mess up is like using the camera as a spot. Like, I'm going to hunt right here where the camera is at. And instead of like, I'm going to put it in a spot that I can't hunt because the wind swirl's too bad, but I can get inventory and I can figure out which way the deer are coming from and then hunt adjacent to it.
Yes.
That's, anyway. So I think if you use it as a spot, like, I'm going to hunt exactly right on top of it, it might not be the case. But also, you know, what you're talking about, like these tight little bottoms,
mm-hmm.
you could easily kill a deer there. You just got to have the right conditions so your wind doesn't swirl. And also the time of the year, and the acorns produce, and so on. But yeah, I don't agree with that. But that's why it's a hot take. You don't have to agree. That's what a hot take should be.
Yeah.
If everybody agrees with it, it's not a hot take.
Yeah. The only reason I say I disagree with it is because I've kind of changed how I've been using cameras in the last 3 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think that if you like one of the reasons I'm putting my cameras on those big trail intersections. Is because even if they're using it at nighttime, if I can get a near daytime picture there mm-hmm. at some point, because I'm still doing it close to cover.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can get a near daytime picture, like if he's there at like 5 o'clock in the morning or even 4 o'clock in the morning, and I can get, he's on this trail and he's going this way at this time,
mm-hmm.
well, then I can kind of think back of the previous scouting I've done out there. And say, okay, I know that trail runs to this thicket or this whatever, like this feature, like that trail is going somewhere. So I'm like, why was it going there at this time? And once you start getting more pictures of him, you can kind of start building a little bit more of an idea of what he's actually doing there, mm-hmm. I feel like. On some deer, it's easier to do with others, though, for sure. But I think it's still valuable information. Yeah. Not necessarily just trying to find a spot where he's daylighting on camera,
mm-hmm.
which I tried to do for a long time and it never really worked. So let's see what else we got here. This is from Case Bogue. Question, when placing trail cameras on feed trees in the coming weeks and months, would you pick out a tree that you think will be hot once it starts dropping or wait until after it starts dropping and let the deer sign do the talking? I've tried both of these. With like kind of mixed results. Like if you go out and you scout a feed tree, like let's say you find a white oak and it's just loaded and you know it's going to start dropping at some point,
mm-hmm.
you could go ahead and put a camera on that right now. But the problem is that tree's not going to really drop until, at least in our part of Alabama, it's not going to start dropping until mid to late October. So it's going to be sitting there for a long time doing nothing, essentially, until that tree starts dropping. So I kind of avoid doing it at this time of year, except in certain circumstances. Like last year, you remember where we built that recurve blind?
Mm-hmm.
I put a camera right there on those white oaks pretty early. It was probably in late August. And I only put it there, though, because there's fresh tracks around it already. Like, the deer were already going past that tree naturally. There was trails that came out next to it. There's a pine thicket right next to these white oaks. Trails came out of the pine thicket and went right underneath them. So I'm like, well, when this starts dropping, they're definitely going to start picking some of these up because they're already walking right over it. So in that situation, maybe, yeah, go ahead and put them out. But just a random tree in the woods, I don't know how well that's going to be.
I think if it's a isolated oak, depending on where you're at, you know, what they're selecting for, but say it's a white, like isolated white oak, super tight to cover,
mm-hmm.
maybe not a bad idea to throw a camera up on it. As long as, like, you've glassed, you've taken your binos out, you glassed it, there's acorns in that tree, it's producing, they haven't dropped yet. I don't think that'd be a bad idea, or a persimmon tree. Or grower persimmons. Now, I thought back to while you were reading that question from Case, Jonathan Moreland, one of the episodes we talked to him about with feed trees, he had mentioned, and he had photos specifically on persimmons, big persimmons in a river bottom over in Arkansas, and putting cameras on them and getting deer inventory to those because they're so highly selectable in his area. There's not a ton of them. Like, you find a big tree, you put a camera up on it, and you can get some really good inventory. But I don't think he ever mentioned about putting it on any individual oak because there's abundance of oak in a lot of that habitat. But I think if it's isolated oak in and around cover, that might be fruitful for you. Or like a couple isolated big persimmon trees, you know, you can try that out. But again, it comes back to the window of when they're going to drop versus if it's even feasible for you to hunt it too,
mm-hmm.
to get in there. Because also, I think of like some of these isolated oaks, if it's in the middle of a pine stand, it might be pretty tough for you to get in there too. And it goes back to like, there's spots that like, hey, it's a one and done thing. Like I can, you know, when I go in there, and I come back out, I'm going to be educating a ton of deer, but maybe I can kill them on that first trip. Mm-hmm. Great. But yeah, I wouldn't necessarily put it on any one individual oak tree in a big creek bottom or river bottom. Just because, again, it's going to change so much. And there's going to be so many other trees. I feel like that's just, you find the hottest sign, you set up accordingly, you know, for that. Or you find where some of the deer are actually coming out of some kind of thick cover or a feature like that tree, that fallen maple that they're going around, put it up there. And then, you know, if they're down there feeding on any of those oaks, probably at some point they're going to be walking around that one down tree, and you're going to get a lot better inventory that way. And then just let the sign talk to you about it. But, yeah, that's kind of my thought on it. I've never been all that interested because I put up cameras before on public where I found feed sign, and I'd get some does and stuff, but it wasn't like one individual tree. It'd be like in one fork of a bottom, like a little mini hub, find four or five trees deer feeding on, put a camera there, but then you walk 200 yards around the edge of this clear cut, and there's more oak trees dropping here that they're feeding on,
mm-hmm.
and you go another couple hundred yards, you find more, and it's like, okay, they have three options within 300 yards of this clear cut that they can come out at different spots and go to these different trees. Yeah, you could put a camera on every single one of those spots, but I don't know how efficient that's going to be.
Yeah.
Because the thing you look at, like a camera like that, if they're coming to a feed tree, they're spending a lot of time there. This kind of comes back to a scrape. Scrapes are amazing for inventory for deer. Also, a problem with scrapes, and we've dealt with this, or you've dealt with it, some of the cameras you put out, is if they spend a lot of time on that scrape, they're going to be looking. And that's where you get a lot of bucks that actually bust on a camera.
Yeah.
They see a camera, and they're like, ooh, I don't, and you don't see that deer for a long time. Okay? Yeah. I feel like could be the same situation on a feed tree. If it's one or two trees, you get that camera there, specifically on video mode. I think a photo is not that big of a deal because this is that quick shutter. And again, some cameras are better than others. Some glow red, mm-hmm. Like the flash glows red on some of these cameras where deer can see it. But if they're spending a lot of time under a couple, like two trees next to each other feeding, they're going to be spending that time feeding and looking around them. It's a lot higher odds that they're going to notice that camera, especially a mature buck. It goes back to like the first question of today talking about, you know, potentially educating mature bucks noticing cameras, that could come back to potentially bite you in the butt a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So just take that in consideration as well. Because, I mean, we've had bucks notice cameras. That camera's 8.5-9 feet off the ground.
Yep.
But it's adjacent to when they get their head up in that looking branch and they cock their head over to the left, they see that camera's right there.
Yep, yep.
So, again, you know, kind of goes back to the first question. Just kind of be a little cautious with it. Some deer won't care. Some deer care. They're all a little bit different. Some are quirkier than others.
All right, we got a great hot take from Gabe Heft. Great one.
Oh, old Arkansas boy.
All right. This is from Circle. Gabe Heft commented. He said, hot take. Extreme mobile hunting has saved more bucks than it has killed. Explanation, when the influencers started telling us that I don't ever sit in the same tree twice and walk until you find the freshest sign, it appeals to a lot of us. It's the sexy way to hunt, but it winds up with us jumping from spot to spot like a jackrabbit chasing daylight pics of the buck we want to kill, and we lose the art of patience and learning the habits of the animal we pursue. What do you think?
That is a hot take. And I think that's partly valid, if not valid, in specific areas. And I say specific areas, what I'm thinking of is like low deer density. He's up in the mountains in Arkansas, northern Arkansas. Low deer, if you're in low deer number areas, low deer densities, with traveling bucks specifically during the rut, okay? I think that could bite you in the butt a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of kind of locking down on like a quality doe bedding area and or great train features that funnel, like that a buck's going to walk through very specific locations to check some of these bedding areas.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could shoot yourself in the foot by just bouncing around too much. Listen,
mm-hmm.
I still bounce around, but I've really laid back on that a little bit. More recently, it's like you find something that's really good, just kind of like, I might not climb the same tree, but I can see the tree I climbed the day before.
Yeah.
You know, in that area, and hunt it accordingly. But definitely, I think if you bounce around, like Devin Duncan, I think, has talked about that, which we got to get him back on the show, about like finding those really good features like up in the mountains. And now he's up in Virginia, but finding those really good features, terrain features that like you lock down on for a couple of days, because that buck might be 3 miles away from you. Again, talking the rut, 3 miles away from you, and he's running this giant long ridge system back around to you, and he's making a big loop. You might not see him for 2 days, but that third day you sit in there, he shows up. He didn't even know you were there because it's the first time he's walking through that spot. Versus an area with high deer densities, smaller home ranges, that's that circumstance where he's kind of always in there. You hunt that same spot over and over again, you're kind of already close to being in his bubble, potentially. You know, just educate them, especially if you don't have a good access point.
Yeah.
But no, I think there is something about the whole patience aspect stuff that's changed too. You know, want to go see new land, new areas. And also he's talking about from a public land hunter perspective, because he's a public land hunter. You know, this is different. You know, if you got 40 acres, you get that much ground to work with. You don't have a lot to go walk around and try different spots out. But on big tracts of public land, you have that flexibility, that capability. And I definitely feel like you can kind of chase yourself in a circle chasing daylight trail cam photos, which you were bad about that a couple of years ago. Bucks show up on camera, Andrew's running up there, gonna, you know, get up and go hunt it. Don't see nothing. Then he shows up over here. It's like, you know.
It's like playing whack-a-mole.
Yeah, it's that's a great way to burn yourself out where you do not have any fun. But also sitting in a spot for a couple of days is not that fun too. If it's slow for a couple of days, it's hard to keep having the confidence that you're going to sit there knowing that that buck's going to come back through there. I mean, that's tough too. But definitely I feel like the patience I think patience is a underlying factor of woodsmanship that some people probably wouldn't consider it. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you why. It's having the confidence of what you found in an area is worth you putting time there during the right time of the year when it makes sense in order for you to open up that opportunity instead of always trying to find the newest, hottest thing. Because I love hot sign, fresh sign. I love in-season scouting. So like in-season scouting definitely will make you jump around a little bit because you find something here, you lock down on it for a little bit. If it doesn't pay off in a couple of days, okay, you know, try something else out. But if you have very limited time to hunt, sometimes just having those tried and true spots is going to be super, super beneficial for you. And you learn that over years of experience, years of running cameras and seeing the patterns of how deer use it, when they use it, the daylight activity, the annual patterns, and so on. And it's hard to build annual patterns if you can't, if you're constantly jumping around all over the place.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot to be said about the what he said, the art of patience and learning the habits of the deer.
Yeah.
Because that's something I've tried to focus more on these last couple of years, and I feel like it's really worked out well. And, you know, when me and Michael were riding around the club the other day, we were riding around one of those pine thickets that tends
to... There's so many Michaels, you got to call him Pike.
Pike. I was riding around with the Dilla.
Because I was thinking stepdad, Mike. Anyway.
We were looking at one of those pine thickets that holds a lot of deer. And you remember me and you turkey hunted the club like the last week of season. Mm-hmm. And we cut through that pine thicket. Mm-hmm. And you get out on one of those ridge points and it's like an open field almost in the middle of those pines. And I was telling Michael about that because I was like, yeah, they bed in here and there's little openings in it. And I was like, a couple years ago, hunting where we used to hunt, I would be in that thing for sure. I would be in one of those openings. But I was telling him, I'm like, I don't really think you have to do that, especially here. Like, the deer are pressured, and they have their areas that they're comfortable in, but the deer, they expose themselves in certain areas that you don't have to work that hard to get to, and you don't have to be that invasive to get to either. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of keeping them on whatever pattern they've established with the pressure that's on that club.
Yep.
You can hunt them on that pattern as long as you don't knock them off that pattern. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Like, these guys hunt these normal spots. The deer know how to avoid them. Well, that's a pattern in and of itself. So as long as you don't mess that up, you can take advantage of it. And that's what I was saying to him is, like, I would love to go hunt one of these little openings in the pines. It'd be really cool. But, like, I just don't think that you need to do that, like, at all. I think it'll probably hurt more than it helps, actually.
Yeah.
So I haven't tried it yet. But another thing that Gabe said, he said, this is great. This would make a good episode topic. There are three elements to killing a buck: who, where, and when. Who is simply the specific deer you want to take. You have to verify the quality you want actually lives in the woods that you hunt. Where is the hard part. You've got to figure out the place to kill that specific animal. It might be a scrape. It might be a terrain feature or four coming together. Every buck has one, and you have to find it before you want to hunt that deer. When is the timing of killing that deer? Learn when he's there. It might be any time of year, or it might be a specific window of time. Don't hunt that deer until you know the where and the when.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good. I like that.
And it kind of goes back to one of the other questions where we're talking about, like, guys like Alan Summerford, who has that nailed down on some of the private land that he's got access on. He knows the who, when, and where of those individual deer, and most of them are like multi-year kind of chases, or like letting the deer get old enough where, like, not only is he building history with the deer and, like, how he's using the inner area, but also getting to the age and or size that he wants to try to take. And once it gets to that point, he's already got the background of a couple years of history with him. He already knows where he likes to use and what time of the year he really likes to be daylight active in a certain spot. And that's how he's able to go in there and be successful in a pretty tight window of time.
Yep.
Instead of chasing his tail all the time. But yeah, like what Gabe's talking about, that's something you do not typically do within a couple months of finding a deer. Like, that is, I would say, a much more multi-year endeavor of finding deer. That's when Gabe runs a lot of cameras, finds a lot of really good bucks, and he's always keeping inventory and kind of backlog. I don't know how he documents all of it, but keeping up with a bunch of different deer. And I think over a season or two, you kind of figure out which one is more killable than the others. And if he's potentially more killable, I think that's another thing. Is he killable or not?
Mm.
Like, is he in an area where you find him using it? Is it an area, first off, you got permission to hunt?
Yeah.
Because if you're like, if you're on a small piece of private, or you're on the edge of public and he's coming off, if you're on public and he's coming off a small strip of private land that, you know, that's where he's spending a lot of his time, he might not be super killable other than a very short window of time. And I think all that kind of plays a factor for you in order to, you know, have an opportunity at a specific deer. I'll say this right now. I do not hunt specific deer because I do not run trail cameras. Can't hunt a specific deer unless you have a photo of the deer. It's like, oh, there's one in here who's got a pretty good track. He's leaving a pretty good sign. I don't know if it's the one I killed or not, but, you know, happy. But if you're doing that, I think there's just a ton of people, because of the popularity of trail cameras, guys want to kill a very specific deer, and I think he's 100% right. Like, you got to find the when, where, and who.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's good bringing up Alan. You know, there's some there's a couple guys that talked to me at the World Deer Expo in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. I won't name them because they're hunting a really nice deer here in Alabama.
Public or private?
Private.
Okay, cool.
Small property. They got permission on. Teenagers. They're like, they're pretty young, but like they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And they've got pictures of this deer from last year. Like, I gave them my email, been emailing them back and forth, because they were asking about advice about, you know, how to scout for him, what to do this year. And they had him in daylight last year, and they just couldn't catch up with him. And they've got him again already this summer on camera, so they know he's still alive. And I was emailing them the other day because they sent me pictures of the property and all that. I was like, you need to go listen to Alan Summerford's episode, because Alan is better than pretty much most people that we know when it comes to killing specific bucks on especially smaller properties, which their property's not that big. Mm-hmm. And it ties into what Gabe said too. Like, they've got the who, and really they've got the where and the when. And I told them, I was like, you need to go listen to Alan's episode to like fine tune it, because they were like, what do we need to do to scout or get ready? I'm like, I think that you kind of already know where and when you can kill him. You just need to make sure that your access is dialed, like you can get in and out really easily, like all that stuff. So go listen to Alan's episode. So hopefully they know who they are if they're listening to this. I hope they kill that deer and check back in with us. All right, this is from the website. Email submission. This is from Jaden Fincher. He said, what's y'all's take on buck bedding year after year? I've had multiple deer on camera consistently and in daylight near bedding thickets, and as such, I hang cameras next to... Whoa, hold on. It's a little jumbled. Hold on. The next year in the same spots, and they don't appear to be using the same bedding year to year. Curious in y'all's thoughts on the subject. Okay, so he's got multiple deer on camera consistently in daylight near bedding, but then they don't show up the next year. I think it's a habitat thing, like how the habitat changes.
Yeah.
If you're putting it next to thick cover, is that thicket changing? Is it becoming not thick anymore? Or is a different thicket appearing that's more prime? It's got more cover, it's got more food in it, it's in a better location. Like, if they're shifting, they're probably not shifting far.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on your area, but they're probably not shifting that far. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say habitat, because a bedding thicket, which typically for us, when we talk about that, in timber cutting country, is like a, specifically for me, is anywhere between like maybe a 3-year-old clear cut and like an 8-year-old clear cut. Pine stand. Like a 3-year-old pine stand where they just plant them, and those pines are like, you know, anywhere between waist to like chest high. Sometimes head high, but they're spaced out. There's still a lot of brush and grass and forbs and everything mixed into it, all the way to like a dog hair thick pine stand at 8 years old, which there's still some greenery in it, but it is just dog hair thick. You physically cannot look into it. Mm-hmm. But they're all in that stuff, especially if there's like those little openings you talked about in the club.
Yep.
Where they have some habitat diversity mixed in with it. That stuff absolutely can age out in 1 year, because you might find it the last good year it's there, and then all of a sudden it's gone, it's changed, and they're moving off to something else. But also, it could be indicative as well from the mast crops. You know, if you've got really like a really good mast year, and there's one thicket that sets up really good to an oak bottom, and there's a creek drainage right there that is just slam full of acorns, they're gonna move a little bit. Maybe to a little bit less quality bedding cover, they'll be closer right there where they still have maybe, they don't have as thick covers they want, but it's thick enough for them to feed. If that mass doesn't play out the next year the same way, they're going to go back to wherever they're the most comfortable.
Yep.
And be a lot more eating just browse and not so much on the mass. So it wouldn't surprise me if people, and you, well, I feel like you saw that in one place, bad mass year versus good mass year. A couple of years ago, when you had a bad mass crop year, y'all went in, hunted a place for a couple of days in a row, you and Mike, and the deer were not there.
Yeah.
And then I was on a different section of the public land, not that far from you. I mean, a mile and a half, 2 miles maybe. And there was pretty good mass there, and there were deer slap everywhere.
Yep.
Bucks, should have shot one, didn't shoot them. Anyway, it was really good. But it was just a different section that had a little bit better bass crop, and the deer were in there. Now that bedding's a little bit different too, compared to like, well, the example I gave with like the clear cuts and everything. But to me, the food, like mass, like acorn specifically will move a deer, especially if it's a very limited resource that year and there's not an abundance of them, move them to potentially where they're at. But that's just kind of my thought. My thought's the habitat and or food shift, food change on that area. But another reason why, like, it's nice to know where there's a bunch of bedding areas, which again is that thick visual obstruction cover, you know, specifically in the south, something that also has food in it, browse that's mixed in with it. Because the more of those areas you know, the more options you have to kind of bounce around from, whether you're running trail cameras, you're scouting it and or hunting it to figure out exactly where those deer are at. And tracks will not lie. If you have that stuff, especially like split between a little dirt road bed or something, figuring out which one starts having sign pop up around it and or tracks coming popping up through it, you can kind of figure out which one they're using the more so, even without trail cameras. Yeah, it'll shift. I mean, it's just one of those things that don't ever feel like you have it completely figured out, because you don't. Deer move. They do stuff differently year to year. And like some of the guys we've interviewed on the podcast, like actually it was who I thought we were going to drop this Monday. I think we're going to hold on to him for a little bit. Older gentleman.
Oh, yeah.
81.
Yeah.
But Mr. Phillip, but like, he's 81. He's like, I learn something new every year. Mm-hmm. I've been doing this since I was 15.
Yep.
He's like, I'm still learning. So don't ever feel like you learned it, you know it all, because you don't. I mean, nobody does. You're constantly learning, and you gotta, you know, remember that, because it's gonna keep moving. Stuff gets good. Like, we've had guys on the show who've hunted areas where they've seen two cutting cycles, like true clear cuts on a place, mm-hmm. and how it changes stuff. And, you know, you got to kind of move around and kind of be with, you know, where the deer want to go. But yeah, so. Yeah.
All right. This is a good.
You got no insight on that?
No, I mean, I pretty much agree with everything you just said.
Okay.
I mean, like I said, I think it changes year to year based on the food and the cover. I don't think they use the same beds.
Yeah.
For sure. All right. This is from Brett Powell on Circle. He said, when hunting next to moving water, such as a river, at what wind speed do you see the thermal pull being overridden? Also, have y'all found maximum distance away from water where the thermal pull isn't a factor?
Oh, shoot. A lake's crazy. Fun around lakes before. Lakes and real big rivers. And if it's something like that, I mean, I feel like on especially a calm day, like in October, like calm afternoon in October, you can just feel that suck. You'd be 100 yards off the water, and you just feel it like sucking down to that water. Like, it's that much of a draw. Mm-hmm. Versus like you're hunting like a little stream or something, or like a really little river, like something that's 25, 30 yards across, and it's night and day different.
Yeah.
Like, you got to be on the edge of it or mm-hmm. real tight to it. So, I mean, that's kind of my thought with that. From like a thermal pull. Also, wind speed wise, calmer the better. I mean, it less than a couple miles an hour, really, I feel like, for it to suck super hard, mm-hmm. You know, towards that water, specifically in the evenings. Or even in the mornings, because in the evenings, the weird thing is like it heats up so fast, that water will heat up, like the surface temperature of the water, and then drop back down. I really wish. We know somebody uses some thermal equipment to get, like, look at how thermals actually rise and fall.
Mm.
And you can see it with thermal equipment.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see that on a big body of water, because I'm sure you could see it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure 100% you could see it.
Mm-hmm.
And you could actually kind of test that. But yeah, lower the wind speed, the more it's going to draw. That's one thing, like afternoons, it's like unbelievable. Specifically, but also shade, like if it's like a small, like a decent sized creek or river, heavy foliage shade cover along that creek will make a more dramatic falling thermal along that water than if it's like wide open, like there's a buffer
mm-hmm.
and it's like real sunny and open, you know, 40 yards of either side of that creek, which you find in some areas, maybe it floods out and just like kills some of those trees. But if it's like real shade cover out there, it's going to have even more of a draw, I feel like, a pull down for falling thermals.
Yeah. I don't have much to add to that. I mean,
You need to start.
You're the resident thermal guy, basically.
Yeah.
So, let's see. All right, this will be a good closer. This is from Andrew Hubbard. Hot take. There is more luck involved in killing a mature buck than skill. What do you think?
Yes. So, I told you when we were reading through these questions, I was like, I like this one. I think it's different. If you are hunting for just a mature buck, but not a specific deer, luck is always something that is, I mean, you got to have it. I mean, just the, even I need the deer to go a little bit left instead of going right. Like just that kind of stuff. Like you see, just get a shot opportunity. But I feel like luck is one of those things. Like people downplay like, oh man, like, you know, I'd rather have the skill than the luck. I'm like, listen, be happy to be lucky. Okay. Enjoy it. Okay. I feel like there's so many people out there, or there's a lot of people out there who want to be like a true expert, like deer did this because I learned this, I learned that, and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes luck's on your side, man. Take it for what it is. I mean, listen, not everybody's a hot shot. Oh, I made that deer step in this spot. He ain't no trapper, okay? Trying to get him in a 1-inch by 1-inch little square bill, catch him with a foothold trap. That's a lot of skill, okay? But I think luck is definitely one of those things, like, you got to take in consideration. There's no way. Like, I heard this on podcasts. I've heard this many a times. But, like, luck is when preparation and...
Preparation meets opportunity?
Yes. There you go. And I think that takes in consideration. We know plenty of people. Everybody can relate with this. Everybody listening to this podcast, if you've been hunting for any length of time, you have a situation where, like, it was just sheer luck, okay? Didn't know nothing about the deer. I went and sat this spot and end up killing a really nice deer. Absolutely. But I think that plays a factor for just killing a mature buck. You find something, you're like, I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know what's coming through here. You end up killing a really nice deer. I think skill is also part of a factor of, at least I say skill, knowledge is part of a factor of putting yourself in the right position where the luck's working, that preparation, that luck's working for you, okay?
Yep.
Not just in a random spot, but there's a reason why you're already going to that area.
Yeah.
Okay. Based on something you've seen, you've heard, or you saw, or seen, experience in that area. But hunting, I think a specific deer, kind of like what Gabe said, like Gabe was talking about, there's like his three factors: who, when, where. That is a lot more. Like, you still got to have luck on your side that deer is going to come through there, because it ain't no guarantees. He ain't a robot. He can, you know, decide this morning I'm going to go over here instead of going back over here to this oak flat I've been going to four afternoons in a row, or a food plot or whatever. But having the skill set of locating a specific deer, building a pattern of a specific deer, and getting enough information to tell you of exactly when you should hunt that buck, that's where that knowledge and experience and low skill comes into factor. And that's challenging. It really is. I mean, when we meet guys, which is not, I mean, it happens, but it's not like every episode where we meet somebody who all they do is target individual specific mature bucks. They have that kind of factor with them. And yes, most of those guys, like, there's some luck involved, again, of getting that deer on his feet and getting him to come by you. But you've done all your homework. You put yourself in the best position possible to kill that individual mature buck.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I don't have anything to add. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. No, I agree. It's like, why are some people lucky every single year and other people are only lucky every 5 years? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's what it gets down to, is like, if you know how to put yourself into the right positions, like, yes, there's a luck factor because it's a wild animal doing wild animal stuff, doing whatever it wants to do.
Yeah.
But so you got to, it's just got to be the right day and the right time, like where you pick the right spot, stars align, and that deer walks past that tree on that morning that you're sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you understand the animals and you're a woodsman and you understand your quarry and you understand the woods that you're hunting and you're doing things on purpose, you tend to find yourself in that lucky position a lot more, which is exactly what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think yeah, there's definitely luck involved.
See, I say I'm a lucky hunter, okay? 100%. Like, it's like I find stuff I'm really, like, gets me going. I have no idea what's there and kill a buck, okay? Some years it does not happen. I had a bad year a couple years ago, okay? Or not really a bad, actually, it wasn't a bad year because I killed my biggest buck ever. This was like 2-3 years ago. But other than that, it was like that was the only shooter I'd seen all season.
The one on with Wes?
The TikTok buck, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like, that was different because
that was a bad year for
everybody. You were, yeah. You killed your Kansas buck. But other than that, it was like, can't find a buck in Alabama.
Yeah. I didn't kill it here in Alabama. Yeah. My wife did. I didn't.
Yeah. So, I mean, that it happens. But like, when I say I'm a lucky hunter, is the aspect of finding sign going in there. And like you said, the stars align. Where I get an opportunity at a deer that I'm happy to shoot, okay?
Yeah.
But it still takes, like, you got to, like, find those areas. It's not like I'm just going to go sit this spot to sit the spot. It's like you have a hunch or a reason. Like, the deer I killed last year in Alabama, last buck I killed in Alabama, anyways, this past season, I had a hunch based off habitat. I'd never been to that spot, mm-hmm. okay? But based off habitat and the terrain, I'm like, it's the rut. There should be a mature buck that walks through this area.
Yeah.
Should be.
At some point.
It might not be the day I'm sitting there, but there is going to be, I guarantee, I'm going to find sign. There's going to be a mature buck walking through this area. And it was the first time I went in there and killed him at 11:20 in the morning.
Yep.
Like their luck involved. Like I didn't know that deer even existed. Okay. He came through there. But having the idea, the thought process of, there's a reason I wanted to go to that spot. It wasn't just completely random. Like I had a hunch feeling after looking at the maps, talking myself out of going to the area I was originally going to go there because to me it set up really good for the wind, the conditions, the falling thermals that day, overcast conditions, the habitat, the terrain, everything all aligned for this one specific spot.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, don't downplay luck, but you got to have the, you know, not just go sit in a random tree. Like, Bobby Worthington brought that up last year, 2 years ago, when we interviewed him up at his
mathematics.
House. But he mentioned the whole thing. You could sit on any tree in the woods and you sat there all season, like truly all season, you kill you a big buck. That might be the case. But also it's like what he's trying to get at is like the luck involved. And like mm-hmm. just if you spend enough time in any one place, you could probably kill, you know, a nice buck, kill you a mature buck. I don't think it's quite that simple, but I understand what he was trying to get across.
Yeah.
It's like, it takes time in the woods and you got to find what you're looking for, or you got to spend a ton of time there and get lucky.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one of the two. Okay. But I think if you blend the two, blend like what you're looking for, you have confidence hunting with the right conditions. That's how that luck can be made.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, going back to the bad year that we had a couple seasons ago, that was the bad mast year in Alabama.
Yeah.
I think and last year was a great mast year, and we both had stellar
seasons
last year.
Yeah.
And it goes to show that I think that both of us are good at hunting a certain set of conditions,
mm-hmm.
and that year was not the conditions that we're used to, and so we were unable to put ourselves in those positions, you know, where under those conditions, we were going to have an opportunity. Like, we were going to get lucky.
Mm-hmm.
So, hopefully this year is a good mast year. It's looking good so far.
Yeah.
We're going to have next week, we're going to have a mast report. I'll put it out there to the circle group of what everybody's seeing. I'm going to get a little bit more intel before we, like, put it out on the podcast. But kind of what the mast crop's looking like in different states across the country. Just hearing from people. I've been checking some trees here in central Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have a little report next week.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Also, showing everyone what's going on.
I think one reason why we struggle, like, that was like the worst mast I've ever seen.
By far.
Yeah, by far. Like, trees aborted mast in August.
Mm-hmm.
Aborted acorns in August. And we talked to a lot of guys about this. When those absolute, like, pitfall mast years, where it's just as bad as it could get, what we noticed and a lot of other guys noticed was the rut was almost non-existent. Bucks were not, they were, they bred. I'm sure, I know they bred because we found fawns next year, the following year. But they don't lay down a lot of sign.
Mm-hmm.
They're a little more stressed because, again, that's a super high calorie food source for them. It's, you know, a bunch of carbs for them. But it's like they don't have the energy specifically, like as much energy necessarily, I feel like, to put out a lot of sign and or cover a ton of ground during the rut. And it's like just almost non-existent. Mm-hmm. And like I never saw, other than the buck I shot, which, I mean, he was making a scrape, but like never saw anything that resembled rutting activity or even a much rutting sign, like even the little pop-up scrapes and stuff and rubs, like did not find much of any of that year. It was rough. because again, I'm very much a person, I like finding sign and I like finding terrain features that correlate with that sign and cover and sitting that. And it did not pay off very well for me that year, except for that one deer, which again, that was luck. And I'll be 100% honest, Wes told me the spot to go to. I did not pick that spot. Wes was like, you got to go sit this drainage. I'm like, okay, cool. Thank you. I go sit the drainage.
This is the drainage. Watch TikTok on your phone for 3 hours.
He definitely told me not to do that. But it was terrible conditions. Mist and rain. They had no rain gear. Cold. It was not your ideal day if you weren't prepared for it. But anyway, those are rough conditions, but this year's looking pretty good so far. So,
yep, for sure.
Other than that,
Mobile Hunter Expo.
Yeah, Mobile Hunter Expo this weekend. Love to see you guys there, Dalton, Georgia. It's worth the drive. You can bring your spouse, bring your kids. It's kid friendly. But if your spouse does not want to come into the show and actually like attend the show, they can if they want to. Chattanooga's 30 minutes away. Mm-hmm. You go shop, go hang out. I think they got an aquarium in Chattanooga.
Yeah, take kids to the aquarium.
Yeah, you got a bunch of stuff that they can do as well while you're at the show. So just take that in consideration. It is an awesome, awesome weekend. I look forward to it every single year and look forward to talking to a bunch of you guys. So hopefully y'all come by the booth, come pick you up a Bottomland Freeze Queen shirt or logo shirt or anything else that we've got, and come say hi to us because we're excited to see y'all. But see you this weekend in Dalton, Georgia. Thank y'all for watching. Thank y'all for listening. We'll catch you back here next Monday on the Southern Outdoorsman. And remember, guys, y'all stay Southern.
Around here, fall plots usually go into the ground around the beginning of September, which means right now is when decisions get made. And Whitetail Hill is who I would call before making those decisions. Like, literally call them. That's one thing that we love about working with Whitetail Hill is you can get a real person on the phone by call or text who will look at your situation, your soil, your shade, your goals, and tell you exactly which blend to plant and how to plant it. If it's the first plot you've ever put in, they'll walk you through the whole thing before and after the sale. And the seed they'll set you up with is good stuff. It's premium germination tested blends with zero filler. And their seed blends are built in Alabama, so you know it's going to handle southern conditions. So don't guess your way through another planting season. Go to whitetailhill.com/southern and use the code Southern for 10% off. And if you're not sure what to plant, ask them. Again, that's whitetailhill.com/southern and use that code Southern for 10% off.
If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com.
All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck, and I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy-to-see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy-to-read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic. And no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find basher groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes, or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.